I got to break that habit, too. I've been calling Eugene Hoglan for about 20 years. I just watched your DVD, and I was like, oh, shit, it's Hoagland. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, usually anybody that has a hog in their name is usually pronounced Hoag.
Yeah, well, lesson learned. Now I know that. Maybe it'll keep me from getting punched in the mouth one of these days.
Hi, I'm Gene Hoagland, the Atomic Clock, and this is my chapter of As the Story Grows.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Man, being realistic.
As the story grows.
You got this, Travis. Make them wait for it. Boom.
In the dark of night, abusing a function of light, while others are sleeping, and some are escaping, a stripper's view is a fantasy, unjustified blasphemy. That cannot be condoned. It must be strange to not have lived to find you. It's just a
Thanks for coming on the show, man. Welcome back to the next chapter of As the Story Grows. My name is Trav, and it is my honor to be talking to the legendary Gene Hoagland. All right, that's enough ass kissing. How you doing, Gene?
I'm great, Trav. How about yourself?
I'm good, dude. Thanks for taking the time, man. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
I want to thank Natalie from Adrenaline PR for hooking this up too. She is an angel and made this super smooth.
Very cool.
She sent me a stream of the new Atomic Clock Strikes 2 DVD that's coming out February 2nd. Is that right?
I'm like that, 2nd, 3rd, one of those, whatever the Friday is that weekend. I do know it's February 2nd or 3rd.
Early February. Got a new drumming instructional DVD coming out, which it's great because as a guy who plays drums and as a guy who's spent $50 on those 4-disc Hudson Music instructional things before, you're right. Man, 3.5 hours into paradiddles, and you're like, oh, my God, I can't handle this anymore, you know?
Sure, absolutely.
So your instructional video is more of like, hey, just watch. This is how I did it. I hope you learned something. And some funny anecdotes and some interviews from some other bands that you played with and everything. It's great. I have to recommend picking it up.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And if I might add, off the top, the best way to get it when it does get released is the first way is through my website, hoaglandindustries.com. You can punch a button there and have it delivered right to your door, or check all my socials, check the Facebooks and all that, and that'll guide you right to where you got to go. So
perfect.
That's the best way right off the bat to pick it up.
And I'll put that link in these show notes to the show. So if somebody is convinced by something you say tonight, okay, I got to have this thing, they should be able to, they're one thumb press away from getting signed on for it. So there you go, right?
Fantastic. Thank you.
All right. So let's start off with something. Natalie told me, hey, we have to book this when we did, because he's going to be at NAMM for a week. How was NAMM, man?
NAMM was great. I spent as little time as possible there. I got to connect with all my endorsers and stuff. But as many other folks know, NAMM is, if you have 4 hours, you're going to need eight. And if you have 8 hours there a day, you're going to need 12. You know, you just can't get enough done while you're there. And a lot of that time was spent doing interviews, actually, from NAMM. Okay. But NAMM is always fun in its small dose, you know.
Okay.
It's great. The thing I enjoy most about NAMM, besides hooking up with my sponsors and giving them all hugs, is getting to see a lot of my buddies that you don't get to see a lot. You know, a lot of times your touring schedules takes you away from when they're playing your hometown. And when you're in their hometown, chances are they're gone too. So a lot of times you get to bump into your buddy from whoever band that you get to see for 2 seconds as you're crossing paths. So that's always fun.
Right. Who did you see at NAMM that you didn't expect was going to be there and did the, oh my God, and you guys gave that big hug moment to?
Devin. I got to see Dev for a couple minutes. That was awesome.
Heavy Devy. How's he doing?
He's doing great, man. He was down there doing his thing, and I feel this tap on my shoulder, and it was one of those moments. Dev, what's going on?
That's awesome. You know,
that was killer. So that's always fun. And I got to bump into Mike Keneally. That was great. You know, Mike Keneally, who plays in Death Clock with me, and he's also playing for Joe Satriani at the moment. And
I didn't know he was playing with Satch. That's cool.
Is familiar with, and so is Brian Beller from Death Clock. They're both playing with Satch now.
Really?
Anybody who's familiar with Mike Keneally's career is aware that, you know, he's not only played with Steve Vai, but he also was in Frank Zappa's band for the final 6 years of Frank's life. So, you know, that's a pretty decent lineage there. So yeah, it was great. Mike, he's always, you know, such an awesome guy, and you know, got to see just a whole ton of folks
that's awesome
that you just weren't expecting, and it's always a pleasure.
Did you see anything at NAMM that you like thought was innovative or had to have? Yeah. Or
yes, I started, you know, before I ever got on a drum set, I was a champion air drummer for good 5 years before I ever got my first kit. And now they are bringing that technology of air drumming. They are bringing drums to air drumming now. It was a company called Aerodrums, like AeroDrums.
Okay.
.com. I was walking by with my drum tech Jeff, and we got to catch a little demonstration of what was happening, and it was really awesome. I saw the drummer that was doing the little demonstration. He did not have any special sticks. They didn't have any wires connected to the end of them or anything. He was just playing drums in the air, and he was making drum sounds. And that was
But how?
yeah, but wait, there's more. I think it's an interface that, I think essentially all you do is you plop a camera on yourself and the interface reads it. And, you know, and that's why I didn't get a chance to go back. I didn't get a chance to talk with anybody there to see how it actually works. But I believe it works through, you know, perhaps it might work with your iPhone or something, or your iPad or a GoPro or something, where you just slap a camera on yourself and the interface reads what you are doing and just applies it with, hopefully, no latency right to the drum.
Shit.
Pardon me. There's apparently a war going on over my head.
Yeah, I heard.
Flying over. I live in San Diego, and I live not far from the Mira Mesa, Air Force Base, or, you know, mm-hmm. whatever that is over there, where they have a whole lot of jets flying around this neighborhood.
That's all right. I understand. I've never even been to San Diego, so I'll take your word for it.
Beautiful town.
Yeah, that's what I hear. That's why it costs so much, because the weather is like always perfect all the time, right?
Indeed, yeah. We are told here in San Diego that we have the second mildest climate on the planet. I don't think anybody knows who's number one, but, you know, San Diegans are proud to be, we're number two. So
yeah, we'll take it, right?
Absolutely.
Wow, that latency camera thing, I have to look into that. That's pretty neat.
Very cool.
I've seen those before, too, with the drumsticks that have, like, they look like little black rectangles on the side of them. It's almost like a battery pack. And they're really wonky, and they kind of just come out sounding like old, like, 808 Phil Collins.
They're
not great, you know?
The old Synsonic drums, I remember those from when I was a kid. Nigel Olsen from Elton John's band was the big hawker of those.
There you go. All right, man, so I have to ask you an ignorant question. I've researched. I've been watching you play drums for a while. Huge Death fan. We're going to get into that. There's one thing I've never been clear of with you. Are you right or left-handed?
I am ambidextrous.
I know you always say that, but I mean, like, if you signed a check, if you wrote a letter, which hand would you pick a pen up with?
Something like that I would do right-handed.
Okay.
But there's, just many other things I do left-handed. You know, okay. And I think everybody has ambidexterity to a degree. I shave left-handed. I eat left-handed. I will throw and write right-handed. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think anybody can write left-handed. You know, I write pretty decently left-handed if I had to. So, you know, I channel surf right-handed, but I would hold a hair dryer in my left hand if I were to use a hair dryer. So
really, okay, all right.
And that's cool. I just always try to apply that to the drums. And really, the only reason I am an open-handed drummer, there's only one reason for that, and that was where my record player was located when I was a kid playing in my bedroom to albums, and I would have to sit at the corner of the bed where, you know, the top, I guess, as you're looking at my bed, oh God, what would it be? If you're looking from the top of a bed, it would be the top right corner. If you're above angle of it, the top right corner of the bed, I'd kick my legs over the side of it and I'd turn to the left. And I always noticed that, you know, if I'm playing along with a record, playing the top right corner of the bed, like if you were to start your little drum pattern there and work down, mm-hmm. it would, you know, towards the center of the bed. And so the center of the bed, I guess, is more of a bass drum soundy thing. And the top right corner had a higher tone. So that would be my snare. So that's really the only reason why I'm open-handed. If I'd play to my records, I'd switch the records out, put another one on. If my record player was on the other side of my bed, then I would be a normal right-handed player.
Normal, like the crossover.
Crossover and all that whatnot.
Gotcha. Yeah, you remind me of Simon Phillips with the way that you play with open-handed, and your left, your hi-hat is to your left, and it's down traditionally low because those of us that crisscross, which is most righties, need the hi-hat higher, and you need room so your wrists don't click together or whatnot, you know?
I always feel bad for any right-handed drummer that's trying to play my drum kit, first of all, because it's my kit is set up pretty wide. We refer to it as driving the truck. And other drummers seem to have their drum sets configured like a little sports car. Everything's really close and really tight, and you could reach everything real easy. And mine, you have to get pretty wide on to play. So if you're a drummer trying to jam away on Gene's kit, I'm sorry, especially if you're not as tall as Gene. You know,
you just mentioned how tall you are and everything. I was going to ask about. Is weight loss something that you're willing to discuss?
Absolutely, yeah, totally.
Oh, okay, cool. Reason why is because I have the record, I have Symbolic in my lap, and I never really read the liner notes very carefully until now because I'm talking to Gene Hoagland. So I went through and I looked at the notes, and you actually mentioned weight loss back then, and that was 95, I think, off the top of my head.
That album came out in 95, recorded in 94. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the first time I think I lost 127 pounds
mm-hmm.
At that time. Over the course of time, I put all of that plus more back on. I probably ended up putting on another 160 pounds after that mm-hmm. on. Because I got down into the low 260s right around the time of Symbolic. And then I ended up getting up to, I remember coming back from my very first Fear Factory tour of South America, and the promoters, you know, since we're all a bunch of big boys in Fear Factory, they would take us to the churrascarias, which are the Brazilian barbecues where they just bring, you know, we just call it the meat pit, because you know, it's like they just bring you meat on
like swords, right?
Yeah, carve it up for you. And every night we were eating those, and I came back, and my lady was like, "Holy Jesus, Matt, you just put 20 pounds on, you know." And so, I got up to about 410 pounds then, and so now I'm a little bit fluffy, but I'm down in the 270s now, and I intend to get down into the 260s in the next couple of weeks here, and that's a good starting weight to start trying to get that gone too, because my ideal weight would be I like what my ideal to do is get down to 220 and then take a month and just fuck up and get my weight back up to 240 and stay at 240. So well, so I'm in the low 270s now, and yeah, it's the way I did it back then with death. I think I actually gave myself diabetes because of it. And that was the thing with this latest weight loss was I went for my checkup, and my doctor had said, "Hey man, I'm just letting you know that if you know, your numbers are pretty high. If you keep going like this, by the next time you come visit me, you're going to have to start jabbing insulin into yourself." Oh, and I was like, man, F that. My lady is an absolute, you know, health nut. And she was real patient with me for the first, you know, couple years we were going out. She never tried to push anything on me, but my diabetes was raging. And I came back and I mentioned, "Hey, here's what the story is." And she was like, "Fuck that. Tell you what, I'm putting you on a plan now that in 3 to 6 months, you're not going to have diabetes anymore. Next time you go in, get your numbers checked. Your numbers are going to be like, if they're not normal, they're going to be really close. And the byproduct of all of this is that you're going to start losing a lot of weight." And sure enough, everything she said that was going to happen happened. I've now gotten rid of my diabetes. If you have the type 2 like what I have, you know, it's just something you get from eating like an idiot. It's easiest disease to get rid of. Boy, so anybody out there that might have picked up some diabetes along the way, you can get rid of it so simply. This was the easiest thing to do. And I eat better now. I eat more now. I just try to eat healthy. So,
right.
Always a little bit of a challenge. I always get a little fluffy on tour, but you know, I come back home, and if I'm home for any amount of time, I just drop it right back off. And that's kind of why I've plateaued here in the 260s, 270s area, because I tour a lot. So I tour, I put on 10, 15 pounds. I come back, I lose those 10, 15 pounds, but then I got to go back on tour again. So I'm just kind of starting over in the high 260s sort of thing all the time. But hey man, that's better than nothing. And, I will admit it does affect one's playing. It does affect your drumming, you know, like I have stamina. You know, that's the whole reason why a lot of these old patterns of mine, like patterns on like, say, Death Is Certain, Life Is Not from Dark Angel, that has this really fragmented kick drum pattern, because I could not do a straight, you know, 30-second notes for an entire song. So I was like, okay, I got to break something up here. And fortunately, it became a cool thing that, you know, like it became part of a style. But, you know, so being a big fat guy, it wasn't all bad. You know, helped me create a cool avenue of which, you know, drumming avenue for myself and other people. So that's pretty cool.
No one's left to destroy.
now, if I were to play, you know, I like playing Death is Certain, Life is Not with full double bass all the way through, no problem. You know, I got a lot of stamina, a lot of power, and a lot of precision that is there now. So it's been just an absolute boost to my playing, dropping 140 pounds.
Sure, yeah.
It is.
Plus, there's also, I guess also there would be like when you join a, I'm assuming, anyway, what do I know? But I assume when you join a band and play something that's a little bit more brutal than what the old guy did, that's kind of like, well, that's what I'm bringing to the table. I'm going to one up because I can. But it must be kind of neat to know inside that you're one upping you from 1980 something,
because absolutely
that dude couldn't pull it off, and now this dude can, and it's the same guy. You know,
that is fun. I yeah, that's great. I like that. I never thought of it that way, but that's a great way to look at it.
I'm a really deep guy, man. Wait till I get going.
Absolutely. That's great.
Cool, man. I'm glad we went down that road, man. That's interesting. How are you doing it? Like, are you like super exercise, walk 10 miles a day guy, bicycle guy? I can't picture a 410-pound man playing Fear Factory. For crying out loud, that shit's impossible.
Well, hey, their guitarist does it. So,
well, all right. Tino's not playing drums, man.
That's true. Well, that's one thing that you know, I never felt like it did affect my drumming. You know, it's only after,
really,
these are all things that I have noticed after losing it, because one thing being that big, I would never hide behind my size in terms of like, well, I can't play this because I'm a big guy.
Right.
No, that's where for me, I've always said this, drumming is 90% mental, 10% physical. Like, legs my size should not be moving at the speed with which they did. So, that's where I kind of learned some economy of motion. And another thing that I learned how to do was, one of the reasons why I'm still not like a super demonstrative drummer. I don't have a lot of like big arm, wild arm, Tommy Lee arm swings or anything like that. I mean, I can do that. It's fun to play around with that stuff.
Right.
But, it is just from trying, I don't think I developed this at all, but for myself, I developed it where I could just kind of focus all my energy to my furthest extremities, where I have a lot of, you know, I have really powerful wrists, really powerful ankles, and that's where I wouldn't have to move my legs all that much. Like, even when I was solely a heel up drummer, these days I am now definitely an amalgam. But back when I was only heel up, even my knees would not really move that much. I never really had the big churning leg like you see a lot of the smaller drummers have.
Right.
I would just kind of push my energy right to my ankles, and I developed really strong ankles, like with a real snap to them. And my wrists, the same thing. Like, even though it looks like I'm, you know, just kind of tapping away there, I will always take the Pepsi challenge in terms of velocity. Even, you know, with anybody in terms of how hard I hit and how loud the drums are, even though it doesn't look like I'm hitting them that hard, if you're standing next to the drums, you're like, holy Jesus, God Christ. I get told all the time, I've never played with a drummer as loud as you, you know, so that's pretty cool.
Driving that truck. I mean, you can kind of only hit the snare so hard. I mean, like, this guy can hit it harder and everything, but that little 14-inch round piece of metal or 14-inch round piece of wood is only going to resonate and project so much. And after that, it is just, I love the term economy of motion. After that, it is kind of just wearing yourself out. You got 11 songs to play, man. Settle down.
You know? I agree. A lot of times you have 19 or 24 or something like that.
Okay,
yeah. It's a little bit of endurance that you try to consider.
Mm-hmm.
And There definitely is a maximum velocity, a terminal velocity of sound. Like, if you're bashing away at your cymbals, you're actually creating a smaller sound. You know, like there's, I'm not sure the physics behind it, but I do know that if you don't hit your cymbals with every force you have, you're going to get a better tone out of your cymbals. And your cymbals are going to last a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a maximum velocity that a cymbal is going to create, or a drum is going to create. I mean, you can hit a drum with a baseball bat and it's not going to sound any better.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Just a stick being hit with a good firm, you know, and that's where I try to keep it really firm. Like many of the live sound men that I've used, they go on work with this band and that band and the other band and the other band. And, you know, they work with a lot of different drummers and they're always coming to me and saying, man, all of your attack is always very present. You know, mm-hmm. I never have to fluff your toms up because you're hitting light. You know, I've worked with you for 2 years straight here. And, you know, that's never an issue for you, Gene. So, right. So that's pretty, just try to be real firm and just, you know, have a good attack on every hit you hit. And that's going to work out really well for you.
And I'm sure you've seen drummers that don't have that type of experience and are pretty winded halfway, three quarters way through their set. And now when it's time for them to really bring down the house for the end of the show, they're kind of not the same drummer they were when they came out. Cause they came out just, you know, it's like a boxer. You come out just throwing arms for the first couple rounds. Fine. I'll just let you wear yourself out and then kiss you on the chin and you're down. Cause the dude's out of breath, you know,
do the rope-a-dope on you. Hell yeah. And it's always, you always feel for that drummer because, you know, you're going to sit through this entire set and you see the drummer just coming out, killing it in the first like three songs. And you're like, I know, bro, up there is not going to last. And
right.
Sure, 99% of the times they don't, you know, right. They're just wipe themselves out and, you know, in the third song and you have another 9 songs to play now, bro.
Right. So, and then by song 6, they're playing like a jazz ensemble drummer. and the sound guy is like, I don't know where he is now. I'm pushing all the, sliding all the faders up. Yeah.
Totally, man. You totally hear it too. So
totally.
That's something to always consider. You know, you got a full show to play.
Can we go back to the symbolic notes real quick?
Yeah, absolutely.
I've never heard you discuss this before either. I'm trying to circumnavigate around what I have heard you talk about. I'm trying to put new Gene Hoagland information out there.
Cool.
Speaking of, you just talked to my buddy Josh on the Talk To Me podcast.
Oh, nice. Yeah. That was
excellent podcast. I'm going to put that in notes too, because why not recommend somebody else? If you're really into Gene and want to hear what he had to say about a bunch of other stuff. Like the DeLorean and the boots and the ankle weights, stuff is killer. It's really
cool. Oh, cool, man.
I'll direct you to Toomey's podcast too. But going back to these notes and symbolic, I'm going to read the line. I can find it. Also, to my sister Lisa, for being my biggest and earliest musical influence. Now, I've heard you go as far back as like hanging with Dave Lombardo and being his mentor and being in the studio with Slayer while they're recording and everything, which are phenomenal stories. What influence did your sister have on you musically? I want to go back to like little kid Gene.
Absolutely. And hear that stuff. Oh God, big time. Yeah. I remember it like it was yesterday. Absolutely. My sister Lisa is 5 years older than me. Many people think that we are twins. But you know, she just looks pretty good for being her age. She was 5 years older. I was 8. She was 13, getting into rock and roll. I was 10. She was 15. She was going to a lot of concerts, and they would, my parents would force her to take me with, you know, take your brother with you, you know, night off or whatever. So
sure, sure.
I went to a whole lot of concerts when I was a kid. I definitely had a childhood unlike many, many others. You know, mine is my own. So. But you know, she was the one that was listening to all the rock and roll. She was the one that was getting. Her and my cousin Ken, who was 1 year older than her, they were both my biggest musical influences. I would just listen to what they were listening to, and I was always into rock and roll. I was always into music. My parents like to tell me that when I was, you know, in my late twos, I forced them to take me to the record store to buy the latest Santana record, which was called "No One to Depend On."
Okay.
Backed with Taboo. That was the little 45 single that I made him get for me. And I was super into music growing up. And, you know, then just having my sister bringing in all these rock and roll albums. That's that, you know, what is now known as, you know, American classic rock and roll, or, you know, just classic rock or whatever. All the Kiss and Queens, and even though they're not American, you know, Aerosmith, Ted Nugent, you know, Angel, Black Sabbath, you know, that all sister, and those are all, you know, bands that absolutely helped create me and helped me realize, hey, this is what I want to do. I want to do this as well. So, so yeah, she was an absolute influence, taking me to clubs with her. You know, I was always her bodyguard because my sister would always dress up rather provocatively. And I would always remember that if some guy, you know, I would just split up from her at the club, and she probably didn't mind that at all. You know, I was 13. I didn't look 13. I was 6 feet tall at 13. Jeez. They didn't have the card, you know, the IDing was not that big of a deal back then.
Right.
So you walk into a club and not even show an ID. And I remember I would walk up to her, and if some, you know, dude was talking to her, and she would introduce me as her baby brother, then I knew that guy was cool. But if she would introduce me as my bodyguard Gene, then I would know, stick around, give this guy a couple of looks, and he'll.
That was the pre-planned phone call that they do now, where it's like, hey, call me at exactly 9, and I'll come up with some crazy story if I need to get out of it. Good idea.
Yeah, it all worked.
All right. You said your childhood was unique, and it was your own. What do you mean? How so?
Well, you know, I would go to all the clubs when I was 13. I started to go into all the LA and Orange County clubs, getting to know all the bands. You know, like when I was 13, that was about 1981. And all the seeing all of the bands that later became the LA cock rock horseshit. All these bands were just hardworking bands in the clubs, and they were actually heavy, you know. And granted, my 13-year-old ears were more attuned to their kind of heaviness than my, like, say, my 15-year-old ears, where I started just getting way into underground metal by then.
Okay.
But, you know, when I was 13, going to clubs and seeing bands like Rat and Dokken and Dante Fox, which became Great White, you know, Wasp. I saw Wasp's very first show. I've seen Metallica's second show. That's in the crazy clubs. And all these things. And, you know, my sister would always, she would always bring the, like, the one homeless guy from any band. Like, I'd walk out in the morning and there'd be, like, a member of Great White sleeping on my couch, or a guy from Dawkins sleeping on my couch, or
really,
or whatever. My sister would bring him home, give him some soup, and then, you know, give him a ride home the next day or whatever. They'd just sleep on the couch out front. But, and I got to know all these guys, and, you know, I worked for some of these bands and whatnot. And I was a kid, you know. We would go to the parties afterwards, and I was never a partier in my entire teen years. I never, you know, did drugs or drank or anything like that.
Really?
Okay. So, and I'd always do, you know, I think all my parents, they kind of had an upbringing similar to mine. I remember my folks telling me that they used to hang out with a couple of rock bands back in the 50s in El Paso. And so, you know, my mom was similar to my sister. You know, she would hang around with rock bands. My dad would do the same. And so I all my parents ever asked of me, like, hey, man, don't let your grades slip. Just keep, don't do well in school. And they pretty much just gave me carte blanche. You know, they knew I wasn't drinking. I was pretty opposed to it, you know, drugs and drinking and all that sort of stuff. So, so they were, you know, they felt pretty good about it then, but we would go straight from the party straight to school, you know, stuff like that. I would go to school on no sleep because I went to go see, you know, Motley Crue at the Troubadour the night before with Rat opening, and then we'd go to the party afterwards and hang out there all night and sit in LA traffic on the way down to school. So, you know, that's how, you know, and I just remember looking around at all the other high school students and just thinking, you're all just a bunch of sheep, man. I can't stand any of you. You listen to your little new wave radio top 40 bullshit and you're all plastic. You all care about, like, you know, just stupid shit. And I'm out here fucking living, you know, you're all a bunch of idiots. And that's the way I felt in high school. You know, like I definitely had a messianic complex that I fortunately don't have anymore, but I did feel like I was God compared to all the other yahoos I went to school with. So, except for my friends, of course, they were all cool.
Sure. Did you have that one douchebag that, like, actually came to school with the aha flock of seagulls haircut or whatever? And
oh, I had a school full of them. You
skinny
know,
and tie I'll, guy and
oh yeah that,
yeah
that, you know, whatever was really popular, you know, just like today, whatever's ever popular, and little plastic children walking around listening to bullshit. Yeah. That's what it was, you know, 30 years ago when I was in high school. It just all the, yeah, flock of seagulls haircuts all over the place, and all the girls looked like just new wave douchebags, and they were all just a bunch of idiots. So fuck them all.
I love it. I'm so glad we went down that path to talk about your sister. Cause I get it now. Like 13 years old and being indoctrinated into the scene. I don't know what you would do at 13 years old, sober, after a Motley Crue show at the Troubadour during the week. I mean, I can't decide if that was super interesting or really boring for you, because I can't imagine you found a lot of other sober people to hang out with, or am I wrong?
No, but I actually, that was just, that, no, it was highly interesting, because I got to see firsthand what that lifestyle can do to you. And believe me, I got involved in the lifestyle as I got older. Like when I was in my late 20s, boy, I was partying it up. However, back then I did realize that those who kind of retain a bit of sobriety are the ones that actually are going to actually negotiate their way through this business. And that's what I did. I just took it as a big learning process. Like, you know, if I'm doing well in my actual school, this is my school for life, and keep your eyes open for everything. See what, you know, piles of cocaine do to people, and what, you know, just incessant drinking will do to people. And a lot of these guys, you know, they're still around to this day, and they look fucking horrible, and they've made some stupid decisions. So it's like, you know, I'm not saying I haven't made stupid decisions, but at least I did all mine sober, you know.
Fair enough.
Now, believe me, I am no preacher, you know. Like I don't drink anymore, and, you know, that's more of a health thing. You know, that's the first thing to cut out when you're being told, you know, you're going to have to start jabbing insulin. And I am all for anybody doing what they feel is best for them. But when I was young and I was just a sponge for everything, it was an incredible learning experience to be hanging around with these guys. A lot of them went on to great fame and success in spite of themselves, you know, like, mm-hmm. like Motley Crue, you know, God, that book, The Dirt. I think that, you know, every young musician should read that and just do the opposite, you know? So,
yeah.
Cause that worked for Motley Crue, but that does not mean it's going to work for you, kid.
Yeah. One of them literally died. I don't advise that to anybody.
Yeah, man. Jeez. One died, others killed. So
yeah, that's true. Here's something that I wanted to, maybe this will kind of segue into the death stuff and everything, because I'm such a nerd. Those last four death albums are like biblical. They're like the four gospels for me.
Ooh,
and you play drums in two of them, so they're pretty important. But out of curiosity, there's such a ridiculous jump between spiritual healing and human. I mean, night and day, corner turned. Not that spiritual healing is bad. James Murphy on guitar, I mean, it's a phenomenal album, but Human was the jaw drop. Am I right?
I agree completely. Absolutely. Okay.
What would cause Chuck to not go back to Paul and Sean? Like, how did, I mean, I know how you got in. You guys contacted each other and he says, yeah, come on down. And it's been documented. It's in your bio on your website about how you actually helped transpose some things and lower it, and give it chunk and everything.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
I read your bio. But how does Chuck walk away from Sean Reiner? Sean Reiner's one of my biggest influences. The guy's bonkers. And then kind of same question on the other end. he used you for two albums. Why Richard Christie and not call you back, out of curiosity, if that's something you can discuss?
Well, yeah, I think so. I can, like, maybe starting with the Sean and Paul things, I know that I don't know exactly what happened. And I'm sure Chuck explained it to me probably 15 times, and I probably just didn't listen. But for whatever reason, they were just not going to be a part of anything Chuck ever did ever again. So I'm not sure what kind of bridges might have been burned by both parties, you know. But, you know, Sean and Paul were just out when he called me. And, you know, I actually, I with the ferocity of human, you know, because I cite human as an absolute benchmark for death metal drumming, for metal drumming. Like, yep. That was a game changer for us all in terms of, like, hey, wait a minute, we could do that? Cool, because I want to do what he did. I can do that. Let's do it. And, you know, going back further, you know, to Watchtower and Rick Colaluca's incredible drumming with Watchtower, where you're just like, oh, I have no idea what's happening here. This is great, though. It's super prog. It's over my head. I can't figure any of this stuff out at that time.
I mean, I don't mean to cut you off. You're the first guest to mention Watchtower, and I actually interviewed Jarzombe.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah, shit. I love Watchtower, man. I love them.
Same here, man. That, you know, Energetic Disassembly was such an amazing record. And then they also did a demo for what was the next one?
Control and Resistance.
Yeah. That's
where I came into Control and Resistance and moved backward to Energetic. So it was never Control and Resistance to me. That's my benchmark. But I respect anybody who came in at that level, because they weren't as popular then. You knew
them. Oh, yeah. Absolutely unknown. Zomba Records, all that. And Jason McMaster and I were, you know, we started off being pen pals, and then we just became super buddies to this day, you know. And that's, you know, I wrote to him, or maybe he wrote to me. I don't know who wrote first, but we were both fans of each other's stuff. I was doing Dark Angel at the time.
Uh-huh.
And they also did a demo for Controlled Resistance with Jason that I think has now seen the light of day on a re-release, and that demo is amazing. It's got some of the same songs that went on Controller Resistance that were all killer, and I really like Jason's take on them, and I really love their approach on the demos and stuff. And Alan Tecchio did a great job and all that, but yeah. You know, Jason's my guy for Watchtower, totally.
Okay.
But I think that was a huge influence on Sean, you know, the fact that a Watchtower existed, as well as all the prog that we would, you know, everybody would kind of listen to when you were, you know, metal just kind of gives its way to prog and jazz fusion. And, you know, I was also listening to a lot of Gino Vannelli, and Mark Craney's drums were incredible. And they were slightly on the metal side. He'd drop in some double bass hauling now and then. And that was always appreciated. And I think Sean probably, you know, probably heard the same things that he liked in a lot of the jazz fusion and prog stuff, where he was able to just, I think probably what went down in the writing was Sean would be trying all these crazy patterns, and Chuck would be like, hey man, I can play all my riffs over what you're playing, so, you know, go, Sean. Because that was Chuck's approach with me, with individual thought patterns, and symbolic. Every time I'd come up with a pattern or something that he'd be playing over, and I'd be like, "Is this too much?" And he's like, "No, man, I'm playing cool over everything you're doing. So go sick, go nuts." And you know, when I did get the call for individual, I really did think, like, when we're talking, you know, and I got in my mind, like, you know, death is this just ball crushing death metal band, you know, you got four classic records under their belts. Chuck and I are going to put together the most devastating death metal project ever. This is going to be the heaviest. It's going to take human to a new level. And then I got that riff tape that I've talked about many times, and I was like, whoa, what's going on here? This is not savage at all. And by the time I got, you know,
physically in Chuck's presence. And, you know, we started talking a lot about his philosophies towards things. He was trying to just expand, you know. He wasn't trying to deny his past. However, he was trying to expand upon his future, and writing a devastatingly heavy record, I don't think was his intent. And that's why, you know, Individual, it doesn't sound as vicious to me as Human, mm-hmm. but it did sound like where Chuck wanted to take his band, leading up to Symbolic. And that's where, like, I just did an interview, you know, right before you, and they were asking about, you know, what's Death's legacy? Like, what makes them, you know, a name that always gets mentioned? And this is something I was thinking about real recently, where, you know, Chuck, you know, he didn't create death metal. He never admitted to creating it. As a matter of fact, he would, you know, and I said this in the other interview, where he would always try to deflect the credit or blame, as it were, for creating death metal. You know, when everybody was calling him the godfather of death metal, like, mm-hmm. he was never comfortable with that title, just because he felt it wasn't paying tribute to the guys who came before him. And, you know, guys like Possessed and, you know, Jeff Becerra, you know, obvious okay. influence on Chuck's vocals and things like that. Mm-hmm. But for many people, whether it's true or not, death created death metal for a lot of folks. Okay, mm-hmm. cool. Then with Human, there were the Watchtowers and Atheists and bands like that that were doing technical metal, you know, Atheist, more technical, deathy metal. But Human just had such an impact that, you know, they really put technical death metal on the map, you know, right. to the point where you got bands like Pestilence that, you know, they started going technical. A lot of bands came from that mm-hmm. inception of incarnation of death. And then by the time the band got over to Symbolic, they were one of the progenitors of melodic death metal. So it's like, Jesus, that's how death has remained an important band, you know, 20 years after Chuck's, you know, what, 16 years, 15 years after Chuck's passing, mm-hmm. is because they, you know, it's one thing to just be in a band that is playing an established style, and yeah, your band can get popular and you do it, you know, you play it well, but you didn't create it. Mm-hmm. That's death helped create three different styles of music. And what's really funny is there are so many of these younger, like, deathcore acts, and even the ones that are now older, the ones that were around from the late 90s and had their heyday 10 years ago, where they're, you know, I did a tour, you know, one of the Oz Fests that we did, and then the Sounds of the Underground that had a lot of those kind of up and coming acts on them. And they would all come to me and say, man, I learned how to play guitar to Symbolic. And I'm like, okay, I would think you would be playing in a Cynic type band, but you're playing in, like, say, Atreyu or something like that. You know, that's odd, but badass, cool. You know,
very whatever. Cool. So,
yeah, right. Totally. So, you know, that's pretty awesome there, and that's why, you know, I think that's how death has remained so important, is that
yeah.
they didn't just jump on a style, they helped create and take that style places. So, you know, kudos to Chuck, and, you know, he was never afraid to take the heat, you know, because I remember when we put out Symbolic, you know, it's become a classic now, but let me tell you, man, the average death metal person who was into Deicide and Morbid Angel and Early Death and Obituary mm-hmm. and Cannibal Corpse, you know, of course they couldn't hate Symbolic enough. So fortunately it's stuck around, and other people, you know, for every hardcore death metal fan that the band lost, they gained two new fans of young kids that are like, wow, I like the playing on this. I like the fact I can make out stuff. I like the fact I can play along with this and figure everything out pretty easily, or whatever it takes for a young musician to get themselves on their path. Death helped quite a few of those. So very cool, man.
I've always explained Death to people as Death is the fastest band that I still hum to.
Oh, nice.
You know what I'm saying? Like it's melodic enough, especially symbolic and individual. It's melodic enough that there's still I catch myself humming guitar parts, but underneath, it's usually pick one or the other, or you can hum along to a Metallica riff because it's designed to be a little slower, a little chunkier, a little bit more 16th note-y than 32nd note.
And
Death was just fucking trucking, and I'm still humming along to the guitar parts. And That's I don't know. That's my thing. What about Sound of Perseverance? I think I know your answer. I'll take a stab at it. It's probably just scheduling, right?
No. Well, what happened was Chuck, there's about six songs on Sounds of Perseverance that I helped write.
Oh, really?
We worked on I remember when I first heard it, I was like, oh, I recognize this. I recognize that. Oh, I recognize this. Oh, I remember this song. And the one thing that I was doing is I was taking the drums in a completely different direction than what Richard did.
Okay.
And the one thing about Death is that Chuck broke up the band. You know, he broke up the band. And when he did break up the band, it was on tour and it was a complete act of defiance to the record label. We were on Roadrunner at the time, and Roadrunner had done some things that Chuck had directly opposed going into it, and told them, don't ever do this, this, and this. When you're displaying the band or advertising the band, don't ever go down these avenues. And Roadrunner did. And so rather than kowtow to the label and just go, okay, well, I guess I'm just going to take it, he broke up the band, you know. And it was a sad few days there, man. A lot of tears and watching my buddy, you know, lose his dream. You know, he was willing to seppuku his dream to not kowtow to somebody else's control.
That's badass.
Hence control denied. You know, that's where I think that title came from.
Oh, no shit. Okay. I see it now.
Yeah.
Clouds just parted.
Yeah. There you go. And, but by the time he had put together another lineup, he did Control Denied. He put out the first record, and then he was probably working on both at the time. He probably, you know, I think that's when he decided to bring back Death and, you know, recreate some of the last songs that he had. You know, I kind of expected the songs that we wrote for Sounds of Perseverance, I expected those songs to become part of Control Denied, because I think they were getting closer to that style, drum-wise anyway. I wasn't trying to just be the crazy... I wasn't trying to play lead drums anymore. I was really trying to serve the songs, and that meant don't play all these cockamamie beats. You know, try to play something a little more solid. Make it cool, make it badass, but don't be concerned with... I joke about Symbolic that the drummer's name on Symbolic is Fill All Gaps, which is actually a nickname that Alan Holdsworth has given himself over the years. But I attribute Symbolic because I played every single thing imaginable on Symbolic, and I just was trying to try a different approach for the Sound of Perseverance material. And by the time he got it over to Richard, I've never talked with Richard about any of this, but I would imagine Richard was probably thinking, okay, well, the last, you know, three drum albums were all pretty over the top, so I better do my take
on over the top.
And boy, did Richard ever take it over the top.
dude.
You know,
that album is downright confusing, man. You need like maps to follow what he's doing in there.
Phenomenal job. Absolutely. I've shaken my fist at many a Sound of Perseverance pattern that we play live. You know, like it took me forever to figure out what's that super popular song that everybody, Spirit Crusher.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Does he play like a smaller hi-hat, a traditionally smaller hi-hat? Because it sounds like.
Perhaps. Maybe.
He's got such a trebly, crispy sound to it.
And sure.
Every tiny little nuance that he does on that hi-hat comes through. There's barely any sloppy, slutty hi-hat work. It's all very crispy. You know what I'm saying? And like,
indeed.
Man, you got to nail it. Perfect.
Yes. And so it took me a year to learn that song. You know, it's like when I jumped in and started playing shows with the band, everybody's like, oh, you want to play Spirit Crusher? People seem to like that one. I'm like, okay, let's do it. And then I listened to it and I was like, oh, Jesus Christ. Okay, I will get this. We will play this live. But it took me a year of figuring it out. It took me a year of playing it in sound checks with everybody and not getting it. That little middle part where Richard just, he's throwing drums down the stairs and just...
Yeah, it totally sounds like he chucked his drum set in the dryer and recorded it. Yeah.
Yes. And I figured out the pattern. I figured out the application of what he was doing. I finally figured it out. Usually, if you know, that's what the drums are, that's what the mindset of drums are, 90% mental, 10% physical. Usually, if I can figure it out, I can play it. But that was just the start. Okay, you figured it out. You can tap along with your fingers as you're listening to it on your iPhone. Trying to play it, however, was another challenge. But finally got it. I'm really proud of that. And yeah, Richard wrote a very insane, very progressive part that I think only Richard knows how to truly play. But if somebody is going to fake it, that's going to be me. And I do a pretty decent job of it now.
Fair enough. Good enough. Navigated your way through it.
Yeah.
Very good. We're about 55 minutes in. Are you okay on time?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. This is my last one for the day. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I don't want to keep you, but I just have like 17 or 18 more questions. No, I'm kidding.
I'll try to give shorter answers. That's probably why they schedule these things the way they do, because they've realized that Gene doesn't just give two-word answers.
Dude, it's a podcast. I love the long-windedness of it. If you got stories to tell, people are going to listen. So, I mean, I don't like
I am long in the wind.
Are you excited about the new album? Yes. Do you think it's the best one you've ever written? Yes. Are you going on tour? Yes. Like, who wants to read that again? You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I'd rather hear stories about your sister and like being a bodyguard and bouncing some dude down the steps because he got too weird with or something. That's nice. Fun stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. So as far as filling in, like your whole last minute thing, you remind me of, what's his name? Derek Roddy with his, like, I got hired and ran to the airport, listened to it on the flight, got there and did everything in one take or something like that. Like, you remind me of that type of situation where it's kind of like, yeah, I'll fill in for Anthrax. Charlie's got a sick family member. I got it. No problem. Are you tablature guy, or are you just leave me alone and give me the recording and let me think about it guy? I mean, like, how do you pull that off? It isn't like, hey, I'll try. Oh, it didn't work out. Oh, well. I'm talking like on stage with Anthrax. You kind of can't screw up.
And you're right. Well, that, like, with Anthrax was actually a different situation, because I've been in the other situation many times where it's you get the call, you're listening to it over and over. I don't read music, and, you know, that's always, when I was a young player, I would always get really happy when I'd find out that some drummer or some musician doesn't read music. You know, I'd be like, cool, you know, because I don't want to read music either, because that just makes it all boring. For me, it might be a great thing for other people, but for me, it just took all the fun out of it. So it's just listening to the tunes over and over and over again. And, you know, you just memorize them, compartmentalize them, and I can figure out an entire set in my ear bros tapping along on my chest. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how I learn stuff mostly, you know. But Anthrax was a little different situation because they had so many like newer arrangements to their songs, and Charlie was playing, you know, we had toured with them already once before, and Charlie came to me on like the first or second day of the second leg of the tour. And that's when he had explained what his situation was. And I had, you know, I'd caught enough of their sets over the last, you know, tour that we had done a couple months earlier with them, to where I had I'd seen that he's got totally different fills now than on the record. Cause it could have been a situation where it's like, okay, yeah, I'll play for you. I'll just, you know, bust out the old iTunes and listen to all your songs in your set, and I'll learn those off the album, and right, yeah, we're good to go. But I started thinking about the other band members, you know, like the other guys that are on stage that would be like, oh, wait a minute, what? I'm used to this fill Charlie's been playing for the last 10 years, and now we're going back to the record? Like, oh, Jesus, really? So what I did with Charlie is I just sat behind him during their set, filmed him on my iPhone, just filmed every song, and then just watched a lot, and just learned all the newer arrangements that he was doing. And so I think it was 3 days later, we were playing a show, you know, he had to go. So, mm-hmm. You know, I got 3 days to woodshed for that. That was amazing. You know, like, that was cool, but
that's like 3 days. You're saying 3 days is like long, lengthy, plenty of time for you.
Yeah, that was great.
Usually it's, uh-oh, can you play tonight kind of a thing. And
like with like Opeth, that was
I forgot about it.
Sort of thing. You know, that was, they had lost their drummer, Martin. You know, I remember we were on the Sounds of the Underground tour together. I was there with Strapping. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I walked into catering one morning and everybody was looking pretty glum in the Opeth camp. And I was like, hey guys, what's happening? And they're like, oh, we had to send Martin home, and we don't know what we're going to do. You know, like, we're here, we can't cancel. Like, how do you feel about, you know, learning our set and playing with us? I was like, let's do it. Let's go. And
wait a minute. They didn't have a plan. Or they were planning on asking you when the next time they saw you. You telling me they literally looked up, saw you, and was like, oh, we should just ask Gene?
I'm not sure what their plan was, but they didn't really know what they were going to do. I think maybe if they had a plan, they were going to ask, like, you know, three or four different drummers, hey, can you each learn, like, a song? You know, because they're set during that tour. It wasn't a super long set. It was like 40, 45 minutes or so, but that's like four Opeth songs there, you know? And I think they were just thinking about maybe we'll ask this guy to learn this one, this guy to learn that one, and all that.
Oh, okay.
And, I'm not really sure, but, you know, I walked in and they were like, can you learn our set? You know, in you know, you got about 6 hours or so, and before we go on, I was like, sure, let's do it. So, I just went to the back of their bus and sat there with Michael, and I just pounded on a pillow as he was playing the riffs. And I just had my little, you know, I had my Walkman at the time. There was no iTunes at that at that time. So I just had him supply me with a disc of the tunes that we were going to play that day. And then they went off and did headlining shows as well that I was a part of in the middle of that tour. You know, when you break off from the festival tour and you play your off dates, I was a part of those as well. And, you know, I played it. The song I was most excited about playing was, what's that one off Ghost Reveries? Grand Conjuration.
Okay. I don't know the title.
Because they didn't, that album had yet to be released. And so I thought it was going to be really neat to be playing an unreleased song with them as well. And that's a 10-minute long song. And, you know, I hacked my way through it. And that got really fun. That was super duper fun playing with Opeth. They're one of my favorite bands of all time. So, sure. And at that time, they were just becoming one of my favorite bands. So that was that. Unearth was a similar situation. I went and played some shows with Unearth, and I was driving up to Vancouver from LA actually to do some editing on the first Atomic Clock DVD. Mm-hmm. And when I got a call from Unearth's management saying, we had to send our drummer home. The band is in Edmonton right now. They're making their way to Vancouver. They have a show in Vancouver tomorrow night. Do you think you could learn, you know, enough songs to get them through their set and then jump on that tour for the next, you know, 4 weeks or whatever it is? And I remember I was in Weed, California when I got the phone call, and they had asked me, what's the next major town you're going to be driving through? And I was like, well, I'm going to be hitting Salem, Oregon here in a couple hours. And they said, they called me back a few minutes later and said, okay, we talked to the Best Buy right off the freeway there. Go into that Best Buy. They got a couple copies for you of our two records that we're going to be playing on this tour. And can you swing in there, pick those up, and just try to learn those songs by tomorrow night? And I did. And that was challenging, because there's some real different kind of drumming going on there. Mike Justian was, you know, Unearth was one of those bands that were the progenitors of, I guess, what is now djent, you know?
Sure.
Doing that, all that sort of stuff. You know, and I wasn't doing any of that with strapping. So that was a definite, you know, crash course there. And, you know, we got through the tour and it went really good.
Wow. You had to pull off a freeway to pick up the music that you had to learn.
Yeah. That was pretty fun.
Oh my goodness. Speaking of, you've played with so many bands. There isn't a podcast out there long enough to cover discography. Your discography is one thing. You could go stroke for stroke for them, but I mean, your live performances are like, I wouldn't even know where to start, because of this kind of stuff. I'm just going to grab an Earth thing, whatever. But you've played with everybody. Nothing seems to faze you. Yeah, I'll fill in for Anthrax. I got 3 days to figure it out. Yeah, I'll pull in the Best Buy. I'll grab a CD. What would faze you? Like, who out there would drop your jaw to get the call?
Oh, Jesus. Thomas from Meshuggah. Like, Lord Almighty. You know, like,
that's fair.
I think, yeah, hey, I know there's a lot of drummers out there that could do a lot better job at trying to do something like that than I could. But, for instance, that song Bleed from Ob Zen, you know, yeah. I think probably Meshuggah's most classic track, you know,
yeah.
That's probably their free bird or something, you know, if not one from, you know, Destroy, Erase, Improve. What's that first one called? You know, Future Breed Machine.
Love that song.
You know, those are their two all-time classics. And,
yep.
And Bleed was actually written for me to play. That was actually written for a project that I was in called Pitch Black Forecast. And that was myself and J-Man from Mushroomhead on vocals. And that was a project that started off being like, Jason just kind of wanted to have a lot of different, we were going to have like Trevor from Obituary play on a track. So I wrote an Obituary sounding song. We were going to have Ben from Dillinger Escape Plan play on another track. So I wrote a Dillinger Escape Plan type song. And Jay had been, Meshuggah had put out the EP mm-hmm. on Jason's label called Fractured Transmitter. So what was going to happen was, you know, he had a really tight relationship with Meshuggah, and he asked Frederick to write a song for Pitch Black Forecast. Frederick did, and Frederick said, hey, why don't you guys make it the last song on your album, and we are going to make it the first song on our album. So you guys, you do your take of it, and we're going to do our take of it. And I remember getting that and just going, God, Jesus Christ, are you kidding me? Like, even the, like, I know Thomas could play those patterns really well, but I, God, how many brains do you have and yet unplug to play this song?
Dude, right.
So,
I know I've heard Thomas in an interview say that, I think he practiced, I can't remember if it's 6 or 9 months. He practiced that song. He's like, it's not ready. He ran that song for a solid half a year to 9 months before he was like, okay, I think I'm working. So it isn't like Thomas just sat down. Thomas, what I respect about that guy is he writes beyond what he can do. And then, like, that's how, like you said it perfectly with the multiple brain thing.
Yeah.
He can write drums more complicated than he can play them. Then he practices until he can play them.
Yeah, that's
like, what kind of weird scientific level are we working at that point where he's already one of the most complicated drummers out there and he's like, I need to challenge myself and write something that I can't play yet.
Yeah,
are you kidding me?
That's an astonishing approach. Absolutely. And I can identify with that a lot because sometimes I'll get a demo from somebody, you know, here's the new tracks and I'm like, holy, and you know, they're programmed on drum machine or whatever. And I'm like, right. Wait a minute. Your programming has gone a little nuts here. You know, there's this, whoever's going to play this is going to need 3 arms and about
Octopus
4.
Man, right?
And I'll try to figure out what they did and I'll try to play that, you know, and like Devin was really good at that. Like he was a great drum programmer, but every once in a while there would be these patterns where it's like, wow, what's going on here? You know, and Chuck would try to do the same. Chuck started getting into drum programming too. And, you know, I would try to do the Octopus for all these, you know, individual songs kind of things that I would hear on these demos. It'd be like, wait a minute, this is obviously, you know, a drum machine can play this obviously, but I'm going to make it so a human can play this too. So
yeah,
you hear something that's just above your skill level, but you work at it to, you know, make yourself a part of it. Totally.
Good segue, man. You set me up. I'm going to knock it down now. I read something, I can't remember who. It wasn't Alex. It wasn't Skolnick. It was another member of Testament said that something was cooking along in the New Testament album at 270, and it's pretty much the fastest blast you've ever done, or something to that effect.
Yes, I did read that as well, and I do remember that was actually put out in the press before I ever played the song. It might have been written like that, but I think the part they were talking about has since been augmented to where it's not a blast beat. And I think what they were talking about was the opening track of Brotherhood of the Snake.
Okay.
You know, the opening thing that comes out with the snares blasting away. That got augmented to where it's not a blast beat anymore. It's just me doing alternating sticking on the snare with the kick drums doing a little kind of military pattern underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading that going, okay, well, I'm going to catch a lot of heat for this because people are going to be going, that's not a blast, you know. And, you know, I was even going to make a t-shirt. I know it's not a blast beat, you know, and wear that on stage, you know. Unfortunately, I don't think anybody's really paid that much attention. I'm not a big forum reader, so maybe people are crabbing about it on the interwebs, but I will never see that. So, but I do remember that. And however, there are the fastest blast beats I've ever played in other songs on mm-hmm. there, and they're the European style of blast, where it's the alternating sticking on the ride and the snare and
yeah.
and all that. And a lot of other drummers might play those things with single foot. I'm just way too lazy for that. I'll just chug the doubles doing 16th notes underneath, and that's
yeah.
you know, why kill yourself for a blast beat?
Why let the left leg just dangle there if you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Gets
a little jealous. So
okay. Well, I'm glad we cleared that up then, because I didn't know this the latter half of what you just said there. But okay. Cool. Something else I'd like to cover with you, since you're in a lot of bands and you do a lot of session work, but again, going by what I've read on the internet, and we can, you know, lately this whole like real, you know, fake news stuff and everything that's going around. And again, if this is something that doesn't have to go out, it won't, I promise. But right around the same time that Dave Lombardo was having the difficulties with Slayer, Bill Ward was having some difficulties with Black Sabbath. And it seemed like all of a sudden there was like this, we're not going to pay you equal member drummer anymore kind of situation that seemed to be like a weird financial thing going. And I'm not asking you to speak to Bill or Dave's personal situation, because I don't even know if you know it. And if you do know it, it's none of my business. But how does that traditionally work with a drummer who's quote unquote the full timer in the band? Why does it become an issue down the road where all of a sudden they're not going to get paid the same way? At least that's the perception that the internet wants me to think.
Wow. Okay. Well, that perception might be inaccurate, but I don't know if I could speak for Dave or Bill. Both guys are good, real good pals of mine. I don't want you to.
If I had that question for them, I'd ask them.
I wouldn't have the option of actually knowing. But I can speak for myself, and I know that there's a lot of projects that I'm involved in where I do not need to be an equal band member. I'm okay with being, you know, if it looks like I'm in the band and it looks, you know, to all intents and purposes, I'm there for all the recordings, I'm there for all the gigs or the majority of the gigs, then great. But when it comes to the final, how things get divvied up, I'm okay with not being a band member, because I always have my freedom. You know, freedom to me is more important than, you know, maybe making an extra few zeros at the end of the year or something. I'm okay with where I'm at, because I've always got freedom to move about, you know, move about the cabin. I can always have, you know, it's like I've got my own, brand, you know, I'm Gene Hoagland, so I can move anywhere, and, you know, the finances are always going to be there. And that's why fun is the most important thing for me in retaining a project or coming back to it. You know, if it stops being fun, then it stops being for me. So mm-hmm. if a project is fun, I'm always going to stick with it, because I know the finances are always going to be there. I'm always going to, you know, I can write my own ticket for the rest of my life, I suppose. But if I'm not a member of a band, that means I've got freedom to go be a member of seven bands, you know, and
sure,
that's where certain bands might understand, like, hey man, Gene's double booked that month. But we want to go out and play, so we're going to get a separate guy to go do this. And, you know, then when Gene's available, we'll all reconvene and, you know, do some more touring and albuming together. So I'm okay with where I stand anywhere. And if the world thinks I'm a member of band A or band B, then that's fine with me. It doesn't matter. You know, for all intents and purposes, I am. But, you know, I might just have my pay scale on a little different situation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I see.
I don't know if that answers anything, but that's about the most I can. I'm actually trying to answer it.
Fair enough. I'm not even sure if I asked you a question, really, as much as I just I feel like we went through this rash of like the original drummers aren't important anymore. The members of the band are just whatever. We'll replace those.
Well, I tell you, when it comes to that, you know, that's one thing where drummers, I will admit, do get a short shrift on a lot of deals, because when it comes to publishing and things like that, it's really hard to prove drum beats. Like music publishing does not consider drum beats to be writing. Like, I could write, for instance, on Symbolic, I tried to write a bunch of beats that have never been heard before. On Individual Thought Patterns, I tried to do the same. I tried to write a bunch of patterns that have never been played before. And I think on both albums, I did that pretty well. But if it comes to publishing, if I were to make anything from publishing from Death albums, that would have been merely Chuck going, hey, Gene, you were there from the writing. Let me cut you in on a little bit of this, you know, because you did write all these patterns. There would be no legal precedent to make him, to force him to do that.
Gotcha.
You know, that's that's really odd, because drumming in, well, God, in any style, there's drumming that is created. There are beats that are written that have never been written before in every style. And I can only think of metal right now, but there's lots of beats that guys are coming up with. It's like, wow, never heard that pattern ever before. So. Right. You should make a lot of money off this song because you wrote part of the song. But that's not necessarily the case in reality.
I think a lot of that gets swapped out in pop music because the drums are really not designed to stick out. I mean, I'm not saying every pop song you ever heard, but I mean like Billie Jean is pretty simple, four on the floor. Anybody can do it. It doesn't stick out. That's not why that song is what it is. But it's the deepest pocket you'll ever hear. It's so important to the song, but we can get somebody else to do it. And that's
absolutely
right. Which I guess makes sense. You want to, you know, that's a singular artist and you hire people and pay them. And now that's done. And if this sells a billion copies, you've been paid. Goodbye. But in metal, these were band members. And all of a sudden it was like, nah, you're out. And I just felt like, what the hell is going on, man? Like, why are drummers kind of getting the, as you said, like the short end, you know?
Boy, that's a good question.
Well, thanks. With no answer.
Yeah, I wish I had a better answer. Well, that really all comes down to your singular deal that you have struck with the band you're in. Like, I'm not familiar with Dave's deal since he returned, you know, when he did return in... When was that? 2001-ish? You know, 2002? When Paul stepped away the second time. Yes. And, you know, I thought it was a great move. They got Dave back, you know, and Dave with Slayer is a magic thing, and Paul is one of my dear friends. You know, they're both good buddies. So it's, you know, I kind of stay out of that whole, like, who should it be, you know? Playing drums for Slayer, you know, it's like, Jesus, don't ask me that, because I love both guys, you know, but I am a traditionalist, you know, like, but Paul does great work, you know,
yeah, he does.
So they're both killer.
Cool. Okay, so I think, unless you have, if you want to drop something else in here at the end about your DVD, I want to comment on something.
Well, I guess I don't recall if the one thing I would like to add is just if we didn't already is I'd like to mention the best place to get the DVD is through my website, HoaglandIndustries.com, and there'll be lots of buttons there for you to find and order it up. And I'm working on European distribution for it as well. So perhaps, because that's one thing that is kind of daunting for a lot of European buyers is, you know, postage has just skyrocketed over the past few years. And yeah. I'm that into consideration with this release. So I'm doing my best to work on some European distribution to where it might be even a mail order kind of thing over in Europe, but at least hopefully you're not going to have to pay the, I don't know, $30 it takes to, you know, it's like the price of the DVD is the price of postage for it, you know, right. So.
Well, hey, they may as well buy two then, right?
Darn tootin', they weigh about the same.
I like at the end, For anybody who stole the DVD or downloaded it or whatever, I hope I get the chance to rip you off someday, because I won't. I think that's probably one of my favorite parts of the DVD is in the ending credits, you address the people who are going to shaft you and say, if I ever get a chance to shaft you, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
And give you something to think about, morality, karma, whatever, you know?
I hope so, you know, because that's one thing. And I do realize that, you know, we're all in that boat, you know. I mean, I got a lot of friends that, you know, if the movie's out in the theaters, they've got it, they're watching it that same weekend in their house, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, this isn't some corporation's money that is getting invested in this. This is only mine, you know. I finance all my own stuff. So, I do put these out, and I do appreciate anybody that does take the time to actually dig into their own pockets to pick it up. That's why I tried to make it real quality. And you know, the only person that has paid for any of this, the multiple thousands of dollars that goes into recording and releasing something like this, the only person that you're affecting is me, because this is directly my own cash. None of my sponsors have kicked in any money. I did do a very small crowdfunding thing where all of my crowdfunders, they were very patient. You know, they were pretty much all super awesome about the delay it took. And I've taken care of all of them. But for all the people that just, you know, it's a YouTube society now, man. So I'm just going to go up and YouTube it. And
right.
I'm working on that solution as well. So, all I'm trying to do is make my money back on this, you know, because
sure.
It's in the five figures that, you know, you're not going to put out something like this for under five figures and make it quality and have a good product on your hands. So, it's a five-figure investment for myself. And if you decide to just steal it or watch it for free, hey, that's your prerogative, you know. But I'm just letting you know that this isn't some record label, you mindless, you know, nameless finances that just go overlooked. No, this is right out of my pocket. So that's why I appreciate all those who do reach out and buy it themselves. I really do appreciate their support. Absolutely.
Right on. I'm glad you said that, man. That's cool.
Cool. Thank you.
One last quick question and then we're done. Where's your best guess that boat propeller went to?
I know exactly where it went now. I found out in 2001, in about October of 2001, where it ended up at. And
okay.
Found out that it was in Chuck's mom's garage. And I found that out on tour when somebody had mentioned that, hey, I saw your boat propeller. You know, it was in Chuck's mom's garage. And at that time, Chuck was very, very sick at the time. And I wasn't about to reach out to his mom, Jane, and say, hey, Jane, you're in a boat propeller in the garage somewhere. Can I get that back? That's the precise reason why I never got that one back. And I've researched boat propellers a little bit, and that was just a special propeller, because they just don't seem to have the design anymore that you could just grab another one and go. Everyone I've ever looked up on eBay has this cockamamie design to it that's just real, real tragic. So,
wow, I didn't see that coming. Oh man, might still be in Chuck's mom's garage.
It could be. She might have moved. She might have moved some stuff. It was either in Chuck's garage or Chuck's mom's garage. I thought we lost it. I just flat out thought we lost it. But, mm-hmm. You know, apparently we didn't. And, you know, I wasn't about to reach out to somebody in
sure.
Who was in dire time there. I wasn't about to call up my silly request. So.
Of course not.
You know, I just figured if it's meant to be, it's meant to be, and I'll pick up another one at some point, because that sure would be fun to play again.
Yeah, man. Right on. Gene Hoagland, thank you. I cannot thank you enough, man. You took 90 minutes to talk to a guy you don't even know.
Holy moly. Oh, that went by super quick, man. Absolutely.
This has been great. Thank you so much for your time. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Travis, I appreciate it, man. I hope this does really well, and you know, best of luck to you. Thank you very much.
All right, buddy. Take care.
All right, you too, man. Thank you.
Thanks.
We'll see you.
Love you. Take care. Bye-bye.